serious money laundering allegations against one of the largest banks in the world.
And Yahoo gets its fifth CEO in 5 years. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Tuesday, July 17th. We're also going to check in with some volunteers in Japan who are using crowdsourcing to try and figure out the problem of knowing where the radiation is safe and where it's not.
Also, we're going to hear from the owner of the largest African-American bookstore in the country, which will close its doors at the end of this month. Also, Jeff and I are going to be talking about maternity leave, which has come up as an issue because the new CEO of Yahoo is about to have a baby. It's all coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
A U.S. Senate report rips into the world's second-largest bank, London-based HSBC. A Senate subcommittee says HSBC handled illegal transactions for drug cartels, al-Qaeda supporters, and Iran. Here's Michigan Senator Carl Levin.
Our report details drug money, Cayman Islands, shell corporation accounts, suspicious travelers checks, and more going through that Mexican affiliate account.
A congressional watchdog panel will be grilling executives from HSBC about all this, drugs, money laundering, terrorism. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us for more on this report. Good morning.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, what is this all about?
Well, as you say, money laundering on an epic scale, according to the Senate. The most damaging charge is that HSBC allowed $7 billion to pass from Mexico into the U.S. And the Senate investigators said that sum could only have come from the drugs trade. The investigators also say suspicious funds passed through HSBC from Syria, the Cayman Islands, Iran, and Saudi Arabia.
And what's HSBC saying about this?
It says sorry. It acknowledges what it calls these mistakes and will promise at today's hearing not to do it again. This is following the interest rate rigging scandal, yet another legacy of the whole greed is good culture, which engulfed many big banks during the boom. But as analyst James Bevan told the BBC today, the regulators, both here and in the US, were also partly to blame. They fell down on the job.
Had they been there, wagging a finger, saying, guys, where's the paperwork? We want to know what's going on. Nothing would have been permitted. The harsh reality is everybody said, oh, it's rather smart. We've got a very fast-growing banking sector. It's paying all the bills. Let's keep it going. That was a major error.
And the Senate report concludes that the U.S. bank regulator, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, failed to properly monitor HSBC.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Jeremy.
Elsewhere in the Capitol this morning, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke took his regular seat before the Senate Banking Committee. As always, his words are getting careful scrutiny, and our John Dimsdale is in Washington keeping an ear to things. Hello, John.
Hello, Jeff.
So what does Bernanke have to say? What is the state of our economy?
Well, he thinks that it's losing momentum, and he's worried about the effects of the euro's problems on the global economy, including the U.S., and he's also raising warnings about the uncertainty caused by the fiscal cliff. That's when taxes go up and government spending would be slashed unless there's some sort of political agreement by the end of the year. He said that the signs of a slowing economy are causing consumers to close up their pocketbooks.
Although declines in energy prices are now providing some support to consumers' purchasing power, households remain concerned about their employment and income prospects, and their overall level of confidence remains relatively low.
Well, that sounds kind of dim. Has he done anything to try to cheer us up?
Well, he said there are modest improvements in housing. Low mortgage interest rates have stimulated more sales. There are signs that home prices have finally hit bottom and are turning up, at least in most places. And that sparked an increase in home construction, which should create some jobs. But even with these improvements, the Fed has lowered its projections for overall economic growth this year to below 2%, which isn't good enough to bring down unemployment.
And now for the usual game we always play. Is he offering up any clues to what the Fed might do?
Well, he said, as always, that he stands ready to do whatever it takes. He says one big factor is whether there will be improvements in unemployment. The Fed meets next in a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And if they're going to act, I think it's going to be sooner rather than later, just because they don't want to get involved in the presidential election campaign.
John Dimsdale with me live from Washington, D.C. Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
Yahoo has a new CEO. 37-year-old Marissa Meyer will become the company's fifth chief executive in 5 years. She is a longtime Google exec and an architect of what the tech world calls the Google user experience. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Marissa Meyer's design fingerprints are on Google's clean white homepage and the signature search box, and Google's brand new local feature, which suggests nearby restaurants. In my case, Sushi Taro, $59 for dinner. Navigating Google is pretty smooth, but Yahoo, not so much. Is it a place for email or chat, mortgage rate shopping? Lindsay Turrentine at CNET Review says Meyer could fix that.
Yahoo's assets are sort of all over the place, and she's has experience connecting different parts of the business. She's been very involved in the Google Doodles, you know, that show up on the Google homepage. She can bring a lot of that type of skill to Yahoo to sort of humanize what's going on there.
And hopefully monetize. Yahoo trails Google and Facebook as an online billboard for advertisers. Meyer says advertising will stay Yahoo's main revenue source. And optimists hope she'll copy some of that Google innovation and paste it onto her new page. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
So in addition to the news that Marissa Meyer is the new CEO of Yahoo, it turns out she is also pregnant, due in October, just a few months after taking over the ailing tech company. It's going to be her first child, and she says she plans to work through her maternity leave all 3 weeks of it.
Here to talk with us in today's Midday Extra about what women in power are up against when it comes to maternity and maternity leave is Jennifer Owens. She's editorial director for Working Mother Media. Jennifer, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
So Marissa Meyer is a very powerful woman. Is it easier or harder, would you say, for women in seats of power to take time off? She's not, but you would think she's a CEO, for crying out loud, she could, right?
Well, no, not at this point. She's taking over a company that needs her smarts and her guidance. And so she's looking at the factors and how she's going to make it work. And this is what she's going to work for her.
Do you think that, I know I'm stepping on a very dangerous ground here, but I just want to ask the question. Do you think that disclosing that you're pregnant is something that you should do before taking a job like this that is so difficult and powerful and high profile?
I think a lot of factors come into play for that. I think, you know, how far along you are, what the job is. I've had friends who have switched jobs while pregnant, and they have disclosed because some companies have a year period, waiting period, before maternity leave benefits kick in. And so for them, they negotiated that.
How should a company board deal with this situation? You're looking at women and men, and they know they may have to deal with a woman, say, in this situation who might need or want to take maternity leave at some point.
I think they need to be transparent. I think you need to be transparent on all sides. I really do. I think that these are individual cases every single time for every woman. And so when you announce it, what kind of plan you put in place, it's a personal choice. It's a corporate choice. I think, though, that transparency and a sense of trust, you know, that she can say, in this case, this is my situation, this is my plan, this is how we're going to work it out, so that everyone has a level of comfort on both sides. Then I think it can work.
All right. Well, let me ask you from the opposite point of view then. Are women getting enough leave for maternity? Shouldn't they be given more time to deal with this? I mean, it's something where oftentimes you're having to breastfeed well into the night, and, you know, just taking care of a newborn baby is a 24-hour job.
Oh, definitely. I mean, our country needs paid family leave for men, for women, for people dealing with elder care issues. Definitely. It's embarrassing that the U.S. doesn't have mandated paid family leave in this country. We do the Working Mother 100 Best Companies, and across the 100 best companies, the average number of weeks given to women is 7. We have a number of technology companies, and they actually do better. Their average is 9. You know, overall, technology companies, when you compare them to the 100 best, they have fewer women at every level. And studies I've seen say that they need to have more women. We need more women engineers. We need more women to stay apace with the rest of the world in technology, engineering, in the math-related industries. So Yeah, they need to figure out the world of promoting women into these positions and then how to deal with complicated lives. And it's for men, too. Women are always the vanguard in these issues, but the men come right behind them. So, yeah, if you want to have the smart women stay and get promoted and lead and all that sort of jazz, you're going to – this is what happens. We are complicated people. So the best companies know that this is a short time in a woman's life and that let's help her get through it and then come back and be the brilliant leader that you are.
Jennifer Owens is editorial director for Working Mother Media. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, President Obama was booed yesterday at an event in Cincinnati, Jeff, not because of the economy or health care or anything like that. According to the Washington Post, he was booed after saying that his favorite Girl Scout cookie is the Thin Mint.
All very serious issues. I see.
Yeah, that's right. Turns out that puts President Obama at odds with 75% of the Girl Scout cookie consuming public.
Huh.
According to the Girl Scouts of America, Thin Mints account for just a quarter of all sales. 19% go for Samoas, 13% for peanut butter patties. I count myself with the president as a Thin Mint guy.
Yeah, and I like the peanut butter ones, but you know, it's strange. I guess, do people dislike the Thin Mints? Is that why you would boo that somebody would like them?
Well, you know, the other possible explanation that was in the Washington Post is that he called them the mint cookies or something like that, and so he didn't use the official Thin Mint term. Maybe they were upset about
maybe
that.
Maybe so. Well, it was a day of interesting encounters, I guess, for President Obama with crowds because he was at a basketball game in Washington. Washington, D.C., I think. And you know how they'll pan the camera around and they'll focus it in on a couple. And
the kiss cam.
The presumption is that they're going to make out so that everybody can watch. So I guess the first pass came and the kiss cam guy just couldn't resist. He trained it on the president and Michelle Obama. And they didn't do anything. They kind of smiled and waved, I guess, and the kiss cam just kind of gave up. And there were some boos and jeers to that. But at that point, I think the president, he's a keen interpreter of public opinion. He figured things out. And what do you know? He got another shot. Maybe his people pulled some strings.
Yeah, they probably went over to the kiss cam guy and were like, give him another chance.
Try that again. And sure enough, next time in the second half when it came to him, I don't think they had a full-on petting session, but they gave the people what they wanted, and that's what a politician should do after all, right?
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Goldman Sachs, you might think, is a bank, but they're setting up kind of a bank within a bank. And the customers of this new bank will be wealthy people. Goldman has decided that as a part of its strategy, it's going to set up this special ancillary part of its business to cater to folks with money. This is an interesting concept. To learn more about it, Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore is here with some details. Hello, Heidi.
Hi, Jeff.
So we're calling this thing a private bank for wealthy people, but what does that actually mean and how's it going to work?
Sure. Well, the wealthy people part you've got, the reason they call it a private bank is to give it a sense of exclusivity. So if you've seen James Bond movies or any decent thriller, you've heard about these Swiss bank accounts, right, mm-hmm. where people hide their money. Those are private banks, and you will find them in Switzerland at banks like UBS or Credit Suisse, but you'll also find them all over the U.S. at Bank of America, the former Merrill Lynch, uh-huh. at U.S. Trust. And so Goldman wants to get into that business now.
Well, and to be clear, the business they're getting into is not ostensibly a place for you to hide your money, but to compare with overseas, that makes sense. How rich do you have to be? I mean, can I walk in with 500 grand and they say, sorry, you're not rich enough?
Well, I mean, if you have the gall to walk into Goldman Sachs with 500 grand, you'd be the poorest person in the building.
How dare I?
Exactly. And no, they probably wouldn't open an account for you. As a matter of fact, they made a joke about how they're not there to give away toasters. So stay away, hoi polloi. But generally, a lot of these accounts have $1 million at the very, very minimum, and most of them 5 million and 8 million. And you have to picture the kinds of, this is family money, right? And so these are families that usually have some kind of prosperous business, whether large or small, and a considerable amount of stable income.
Why would Goldman want or need to do something like this?
Well, there are reasons that they both want and need to do it. I mean, one of the reasons they need to do it is you saw their earnings. It's very hard to make money in the stock markets and the bond markets right now, and their earnings on that are going lower. There's something called the Volcker Rule, which means the bank can't invest so much for itself anymore, not that its own investments have done very well. So they need another source of profits, and managing this wealthy money is a great source of profits because that money is just, it's very fat and stable, and it doesn't go anywhere, and it earns lots of fees.
Sure.
And so it gives them a way for them to invest money. And then they can also lend money to corporations, which also generates more fees.
Heidi Moore, live from New York. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, now to Syria and the 16-month conflict between President Bashar al-Assad and opposition forces. The U.S. has been trying to get Russia to stop sending weapons to Syria, and the country says it won't make any new arms deals. But as Peter Van Dyke reports from Moscow, that won't stop the flow.
Thousands of people have died in the months of fighting in Syria, but despite the death toll and international pressure, Russia continues to send weapons to the Assad regime.
We are implementing the contracts to supply arms to Syria.
In a recent TV interview, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the anti-aircraft systems Russia sells are of no use in Syria's civil conflict.
Those armaments are entirely defensive.
And they are worth up to $1 billion a year. Russia lost valuable arms contracts when the government of Muammar Gaddafi fell in Libya. Pavel Felgenhauer is a defense expert with the liberal Nezavisimaya Gazeta newspaper. He says President Vladimir Putin has very close ties to the arms industry.
Putin was against the Libyan deal with the West, argued that the West betrayed us, they said one thing and did another, we lost a lot of money, and now we will not allow that to happen again.
Military analyst Ilya Kramnik says the contracts with Syria are worth even more than those with Libya. Not enough to save Assad on their own, though. Syria is a major long-term partner, Kramnik says. He says military ties with Syria come second to Russia's fears of radical Islam. Still, the Kremlin won't allow UN sanctions, and Pavel Felgenhauer says that means the arms will continue to flow. And it's not just multi-million dollar anti-aircraft systems.
Most likely a lot of this, what the Syrians really need, like munitions, small arms, is going through freelancers. And they can deliver actually in a week's time after getting an order if they're paid in cash.
That sounds like a seller's market. Good business for Russian arms traders. In Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
Now let's turn to Japan. There's been a remarkable year of rebuilding from the earthquake and tsunami, but the effects of the Fukushima nuclear accident will be with the Japanese for a long time. And in many cases, it's not clear where the radiation is okay and where it's not. And that's where a group called Safecast comes in. They've been on the ground since the accident. Co-founder Sean Bonner is still in Japan, and he is with us now. Hello, Sean.
Thanks for having me on.
So what's the essential problem that you and your team are jumping in Japan to solve?
It's mostly that there's no reliable radiation data available to the public on the kind of granularity level that is actually useful to people. So we've been taking radiation on street-by-street level measurements and then publishing those for everyone to see.
This might seem like kind of a silly question, but why do people want to know on such a granular level?
Well, because it can change from street to street. We've seen levels change, 100 times just walking across a street. And so giving one giant average doesn't tell you the actual story in any case.
But are people making decisions in their day-to-day lives based upon the kind of readings that you're reporting?
Absolutely. The readings that we took in some of the areas inside of the sort of voluntary evacuation zone were not any higher than other major cities around the world. So people were able to see that and decide maybe they didn't need to sort of abandon their entire lives to evacuate. And likewise, some areas that were actually outside of any kind of recommended evacuation areas have some very high levels, and some people made decisions to leave their homes or businesses based on that to move to areas with lower readings.
This mapping that you and your team of volunteers are doing, why isn't the Japanese government taking care of that?
That is an excellent question, one that I don't have any kind of an answer for. It's not data that they don't know. You know, they're certainly taking readings, but you know, we felt that people needed to have this kind of data, so we started publishing it.
Sean Bonner is the co-founder of Safecast. Good to talk with you, Sean. Thank you.
Thanks again.
Well, now to this country. It's considered the largest African-American bookstore in the country, and it's closing its doors at the end of this month. The Hugh Mann Bookstore in Harlem has been around for 10 years, but rising rents and a changing industry have made it impossible for the bookstore to stick around. Marva Allen is co-owner, and she's with me now here in our New York studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, why are you closing?
Well, you know, confluences of things are really, we're in an industry, this being my third entrepreneurial venture. One thing that is different here is the fact that we're in a tumultuous industry such as publishing. We haven't figured out yet where that's going, and that's even harder on a niche market bookstore in an underserved community.
So there's a difference between the problems that face any bookstore right now in the era of e-books and all of that and the problems that face your bookstore.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, as I said, this is my third entrepreneurship venture. And my first venture was in technology. So, you know, the technicalities of that was that we were in a rising market and you're going to do well unless you're just really not innovative. In this market, however, it's a very, very mature business that's in decline. And so there are lots of reasons, in addition to the economy, you know, that small businesses have to face. If they don't have access to capital, there is no business.
Is it more difficult for a minority-owned business to get access to capital?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. It is one of the most important things why minority businesses don't grow to the size that they could. And in fact, the largest minority business is not even as large as the smallest Fortune 500 company. So there's an inequity there in terms of access to capital.
Well, so what's next? How do you make this work? And I know that you're going to try to do some online business.
Absolutely. Well, you know, as I said, I'm an entrepreneur at heart, so you know I'm going to try to figure something out. And I think the bookstore of the future is a real interest to me. What does the future bookstore look like, and how can we integrate technology into that and create something completely dynamic and new?
When your business goes out of business, do you think to yourself, well, that didn't work, but I'm going to keep going, I'll try something new, or does it just get really discouraging?
Well, no, I don't think, I think going out of business because the pressures to go out of business are a business decision doesn't feel the same as if you go out of business because you can't run the business. You know, when I looked at all the confluences of events and looked at my pro list and my con list, that was a business decision because our sales are actually up 37%, but our business model is not sustainable.
Marva Allen is the co-owner of Hugh Mann Bookstore, which will close at the end of this month after 10 years in business. Thank you so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
And now to the Netherlands, Jeff, where some lawmakers want to slap fines on weather forecasters who get their predictions wrong. They say that bad forecasts are hurting the tourism industry. They say it's going to rain, then nobody comes, and then the tourism industry just goes down the down the drain. Well, it all sounds a little like an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm to me. And actually, it was one.
All right, weatherman, I'm going to tell you my point. I've got a sneaking suspicion that you're predicting rain to clear the golf course for yourself.
Oh, my God.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, ridiculous.
Come on.
Ridiculous.
It's
happened
weather.
Before, weatherman. You know it. And you know what? I'm calling the weather people.
You're going to say, yeah, report me because it's a nice day?
No word this morning on how empty the golf courses are in Amsterdam.
Well, let's wrap up our global tour here by going to the Australian island of Tasmania, bucolic little island off the southern tip of the continent. Police in Tasmania have felt compelled, apparently, to issue this public statement. Quote, "It is not the role of the Tasmania police to censor internet content." One would think that would go without saying, but apparently in Tasmania there has been a real time-sucking rise in police calls, which led the force to issue its fairly obvious reminder. Basically, look, people, when someone says something mean about you on the internet, that is not a crime, and it's not our problem.
Well, with that, in New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.